Jewish Christianity, the third talk in a series titled History of Christian Thought, was presented by David Crabtree on October 12, 1987, for McKinsey Study Center's School of Exegesis. McKinsey Study Center is now an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and many of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Something that's striking to me in looking at the New Testament is how ill-prepared the apostles and the disciples were for Jesus' departure. It is clear from the account of Acts that they didn't have the foggiest idea of what to do next. They kind of floundered around. And at first, it was their belief that Jesus would come again any minute. And it would appear from the account in Acts that that's the way it's that expectation that they had, and that's the way they conducted their lives, assuming that it could happen any minute, and that it would happen any minute. But as the time went on and Jesus wasn't there, they had to change their expectations and also change the way they lived. Now, if you put yourself in their position, assuming that Jesus is going to come any minute, things like your job, what effect Christianity has on your job becomes kind of irrelevant. Because if you get fired, so what? Jesus is going to come within a day or two and your paycheck will still have not run out. Marriage. What effect Christianity has on your marriage? Well, you figure it's not going to make much of a difference because I'm going to be gone soon. In raising children, what effect does Christianity have on raising children? I won't have children. It takes 9 months to have children. I'll be gone before then. So all of those issues were non-issues as long as they believed that Jesus was going to come back any minute. But as time went on, and Jesus had not returned, slowly they have to start thinking about those issues. And it's very slowly. Because when Jesus had not returned after 50 days or 70 days, all that meant was, well, it won't be as quick as we thought it was. But still, his return is imminent. And that expectation that Jesus will come any minute persisted in some branches of Christianity until this day, but in a significant segment of the church until about 250 AD with the Montanists. We may talk about that later, I'm not sure. But as people became convinced that Jesus' return was not imminent, that is, you can't count on him coming back any day, then they began to face into the issues of how does Christianity affect our everyday lives? How do we live out our lives as Christians till our death? And it is very interesting to me that from all appearances, Jesus did not equip the apostles and the disciples well. He didn't give them specific instructions. He didn't talk about those kinds of issues. We don't see much discussion of that in the Gospels, and it's clear that the apostles were not ready to deal with those. So apparently they were not given a lot of instruction in those areas. As the earliest Christians were all Jewish, and as they began to understand that Jesus' return was not imminent, they began to continue living their lives as they had for the most part, as Jews. They continued to go to the synagogues, they continued to go to the temple, they continued their Jewish practices. There was no reason for them to stop being Jewish. Jesus had given them no reason whatsoever to stop being Jewish. But as Christianity began to spread and spread into areas where there were Gentiles, the issue was raised. What is the relationship between Judaism and Christianity? And that becomes the first major theological dispute in the early church. And much of that is recorded in the New Testament. The most significant account on this topic is in Acts chapter 15. In Acts chapter 15, it gives the story of how some Pharisees who had become believers went to Antioch, where Paul and Barnabas had been evangelizing, and they began to tell the people that they needed, that those new converts to Christianity needed to be circumcised in order to be saved. And this apparently caused a great deal of consternation among the new believers in Antioch, among the Gentiles, because it was not clear to them that it was necessary for them to become Jews in order to be Christians, because that's not what Paul had been preaching. So Paul took the issue to the council in Jerusalem, where they met and discussed the matter, and according to the account, they had a big debate where they discussed it for a long period of time. But the conclusion was reached, and Peter speaks out in favor of this. Peter is recorded as speaking out in favor of this, as well as James, that the Gentiles ought not be required to become Jews in order to be Christians. But that is not the gospel. And then, as you probably recall, there were the four requests made of the Gentiles. One is that they abstain from meat sacrificed to idols. Second is they refrain from blood, I guess eating blood. Third is that they refrain from animals that have been strangled. And fourth is refrain from, and the word there is porneia. And the case has been made, and I think it's quite reasonable, but that is referring to incest according to traditional Jewish understanding. I'd be glad to talk about that more, except I don't really think more about it. But in other words, the demands that were put on the Jewish believer or Gentile believers was that they refrain from those practices which were traditionally most offensive to the Jews. So what is being said in Acts is not that you have to have faith and do these things, but rather a person is saved on the basis of faith. But please refrain, because these practices are particularly reprehensible to Jews, please refrain from these practices. But it's clear that Acts 15 did not settle the issue, because from the letters of Paul, it is obvious that the Judaizers followed him around the rest of his career, from place to place. And the issue was constantly resurrected as to whether it is necessary to become a Jew in order to be a Christian. In Acts, the only issue that's mentioned is circumcision. But there are indications in the other letters that there are other Jewish practices that were being imposed upon the believers as well. And why some practices and not other practices, I'm not sure. But I think in general, the understanding of these Judaizers was, yes, it's true that the Messiah has come. Jesus is indeed the Messiah. But that does not negate all of the Jewish tradition, all of the Jewish laws. Therefore, a person should become a Jew as well as accept Jesus as the Messiah. Now, it's unfortunate that this issue was not worked out fully enough for the Christian culture as a whole to come to an agreement on it. There are issues where that happens, where the Christian culture thrashes through a problem until it reaches some kind of consensus or resolution. Sometimes that consensus resolution is, from my perspective, good and sound. Other times it's not good and sound. But on this issue, no consensus was reached. The problem disappeared. The reason the problem disappeared is because the converts to Christianity became increasingly Gentile. And it did not take very long before the church was overwhelmingly Gentile. When you stop having a significant number of Jews who become Christians, then there's no one pushing for the maintenance of Judaism as a part of Christianity. The Gentile converts, they aren't going to go around and say, we believe that everyone should become a Jew as well as believe in Christ as a Messiah. So there ceases to be a Judaizing faction. I don't know, but I can give some indication. We'll look, I can't give you a date, but we'll look at the chronology and I think you'll see that it happened very quickly.
Right. Kind of the Judaized Christians.
The ones that were Jews and didn't accept Christ as the Messiah, they were not trying to redefine Christianity. Well, they were also persecuting Paul. But what I'm talking about in the letters is those people who were following Paul around, they're saying, I am a Christian teacher. And my understanding of the gospel is that you must become a Jew in order to be a Christian. And Paul's saying, no, 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 that's not the gospel. I don't know that it's ever explained their rationale, but just looking, kind of guessing at why they would say that, I'm sure what they'd say is Judaism has all been established by God. It is not for naught. It's not for nothing that he did all of this. His prophets have died for this religion. The nation suffered and was sent into exile for this religion and came back restored. Just because the Messiah has come, that doesn't do away with the religion. It just means that now we have our Messiah that this religion predicted. Now we can be completed Jews. I'm sure that's what they would have said. When just thinking of Jews now and their resistance to Christianity, it's along those same lines. My freshman year, I lived in a dorm that was... They called me the token Protestant on the floor because there were only two Protestants on the floor. Two Protestants, two Catholics, and I think 27 Jews on our dorm floor. And you talk about Christianity with them, and the first thing they say is, the Holocaust. What about the Holocaust? And I say, well, what about the Holocaust? How can I abandon my religion when so many people died for it? They died because they were Jews. I have to be a Jew. I have to worship the way my ancestors did. To them, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't matter to them whether those Jews died atheists. They died because of this religion, whether those people that died believed in it or not. And I need to uphold this religion. And my guess is that it was a similar thing then. The exile, the time that the people of Israel spent in Babylon, had an enormous impact on Jewish culture. When they came back, I'm convinced that the exile is what gave birth to things like the Pharisees, movements like the Pharisees, and the development of synagogues. They were not going to let the nation abandon its religion again. It's the point, but they were determined that they would not lose it again. And my guess is that the exile had a similar impact on the Jews of Jesus' time to the impact of the Holocaust on Jews of our time. Well, that, right, Paul spoke in very strong terms against them. But they considered themselves Christians. I think that's quite clear. The earliest converts among the Gentiles to Christianity were those Gentiles who had been attracted to the Jewish religion. And they're commonly referred to as the God-fearers. Apparently, the first Christians among the Gentiles, for the most part, were those Gentiles who had been attracted to Judaism previously, and they were typically known as the God-fearers. It is interesting that during this time period, from about 300 BC until about 50 AD, the Jews actually tried to gain converts to Judaism among the Gentiles. The Old Testament was translated into several different versions of Greek, or several different Greek versions, the Septuagint being the primary one, but there were some others floating around as well. So there was an effort made to make the Old Testament accessible to the Greek-speaking peoples, the Gentiles. They were welcomed into the synagogues. I don't know how the seating arrangements worked, but they were welcomed to listen to the Torah being read and expounded. And there were even missionaries sent out. It's interesting, there was one nation that converted to Judaism, the Khazars. Kind of a strange fact of history. A semi-nomadic Asian group related to the, well, kind of predecessors to the Mongols. They converted to Judaism. Strange but true. A great sacrifice. It was among those people that Christianity was particularly attractive. It's interesting that in Greek culture at this time, there was a significant moral void. That is, people were attracted to some basis for morality, some basis for right and wrong. And at this time, there were not many philosophies that could give a good sound basis for determining right and wrong. I'm talking about the time period from about 300 BC to about 50 AD. Well, that was satisfying to some, but it was not to many. There was a general sense that there must be a right and wrong, but there was not a philosophical basis that gave people confidence in them. So Judaism was a very interesting alternative to quite a large number of Gentiles. And those are the God-fearers, the ones that were attracted to Judaism and the God-fearers. So those were very good prospects for conversion to Christianity, and many of them did convert. Now, they knew the Old Testament very well, and they understood how Christianity came out of the Old Testament culture and was tied to the Old Testament. As I understand it, for the most part, they were able to understand that you don't have to become a Jew to become a Christian. But what was significant was they understood who the God of the Old Testament was. What is his nature? What is he like? What does he do? What is his understanding of right and wrong? What is the purpose of man? What is the nature of sin? They had the Old Testament basis for answers to those kinds of questions. But as time goes on, the next generation of converts to Christianity are Gentiles who were never God-fearers. That is, they never sat in the synagogues. They did not know the Old Testament background. They didn't know the Jewish understanding, the Old Testament understanding of who God is and what he's like. What is good and what is evil? What is the reason for man's existence, etc.? As a result, the ties between Judaism and Christianity become weaker and weaker as time goes on. The new Christians don't understand nor appreciate the Jewish background of Christianity. As a result, a split develops between the Jewish church and the Gentile church. Originally in Jerusalem, right after the time of Christ, the Jewish Christians continued to worship in the temple, but they were hated by the Jewish leaders. In 44 AD, James was martyred, was killed by the Jewish leaders. In 50 AD, there was rioting in Jerusalem as a result of Jewish hatred of the Jewish Christians. In 70 AD, the Christians, many of the Christians fled Jerusalem, foreseeing impending doom. And in 70 AD, Jerusalem was sacked by the Romans and replaced with a thoroughly Gentile city. And the Christian Jews were hated even more for having left during that time. So the split between the Jews and the Jewish Christians became very severe. The Jewish Christians were completely ostracized by the Jews. And as a result of the growth of Christianity, the Jews stopped proselytizing Gentiles sometime in this time period, in the mid-first century. Because all that got them was trouble. They encouraged Gentiles to join Judaism, and they just glom onto a Messiah and take off with it and develop a new religion. By 85 AD, the Jews had proclaimed an anathema on all Christians.
So what has happened
is we have the first believers, the Jewish Christians, but they believe in Christ as the Messiah. So they're obviously, the Jews are their brothers. Culturally, they're related to the Jews. But the Jews ostracize them. On the other hand, there are the Christians who are related to them by faith. But the Christians lose track of the Jewish background of their own religion. They become predominantly Gentile. And they end up hating the Jewish Christians as time goes on. They see the Jewish Christians as heretics. Any Christian who would continue Jewish practices must be a heretic. As a result, the Jewish Christians are completely ostracized from the Christian community. And that is a very significant event, I think, in the history of the church. The Jewish Christians that did continue to exist fell into three groups, the Nazarenes. They were Jewish Christians who continued their Jewish customs, practices that were theologically orthodox. Another group were the Ebionites, and apparently they believed that Jesus was just a prophet who was made the Son of God. And the third group is the Elkosites, and very little is known about them, but they were mystical, they were not orthodox Christians by anyone's assessment, and it is believed they may have been the precursors to Islam. He was a prophet who was made the Son of God
by
God.
Oh, so he became...
He was adopted as the Son of God. But it isn't too long before these all three groups disappear from the pages of church history. Certainly before the end of the second century. But they were cut off from entering into the church debate even earlier, much earlier, by the end of the first century. They were not contributing. As a result, an interesting fact is that among the apostolic fathers, and let me explain who they are. The apostolic fathers is a term that is used to refer to those leaders in the church who wrote in the first generation after the apostles. So, for instance, from about 100 to 200 AD, approximately, roughly. And don't be confused, apostolic doesn't mean that they sat at the feet of the apostles and learned about Christianity. In fact, when we look at it in more detail, you'll see that they deviated very quickly from the teachings of the apostles. Only three of them had even a passing acquaintance with the apostles personally. And none of them were actually disciples of the apostles. But these are people, for instance, Clement, who is the third pope in Rome, Polycarp, who had a passing acquaintance with the apostle John, Ignatius, who also had a passing, probably even more passing acquaintance with the apostle John. There's the author of The Shepherd of Hermas, or Hermas, or how do you pronounce it? Papias, the author of the Didache, which means teaching. Didache. There's this body of literature that was authored by various leaders of the church between about 100 and 200 AD. And the authors of those works are called the Apostolic Fathers. Does that make sense who they are? It's just a name given to a time period. Authors in it that fit in a time period. None of them were Jewish. This is the first generation after the apostles. And now none of the spokesmen for the church are Jewish. And the first apologists, the first defenders of the faith for Christianity that begin to write, are obviously embarrassed about the Old Testament. They believe that the Old Testament is the Word of God, and they use it. But there are basically only two ways that they use it. One is they go through and look for prophecies that predict the time of Christ, the coming of Christ. So they see the Old Testament as a source book for prophecies that predict the coming of Christ, that authenticate his messiahship. The other way that they use the Old Testament is to interpret it allegorically so that it fits their understanding of Christianity. This is something that they learned from a Jewish interpreter, Philo, who lived in Alexandria in about 200, I think, is that right? I'm not sure when he lived, but it was not too long before the time of Christ. Philo was a Jew who interpreted the Old Testament allegorically and came up with some rather strange notions from it. He ended up finding a lot of Greek philosophy in the Old Testament by interpreting it allegorically, which is not surprising. The Greeks who lived in Alexandria were doing the same thing with Greek mythology. They were interpreting it allegorically and finding a lot of Greek philosophy in it. The Christian apologists, the first Christian apologists that come on the scene, begin to use the Old Testament this way. They interpret it allegorically. So that is a way that they can get around the embarrassing stories and statements that you find in the Old Testament. They painted a God that was very different from the God that they knew. And it painted a picture of a God that was very different from their picture of God, which was largely influenced by Greek philosophy. For instance, we'll talk about it more later. I've got some great quotes that I don't have in my notes tonight. I'll get to it. Tertullian, who wrote in a little after 200 AD, this is a quote from Pelican. Tertullian's declaration in opposition to Marcion, who was a heretic that he wrote against, to the effect that today there were more who accepted the authority of the Old Testament than rejected it, raises the question whether the number of those rejecting it may not at one time have been considerable. What he's saying is, given one of the statements of Tertullian that in his time, in 200 AD, there are more now that accept the authority of the Old, and more Christians now that accept the authority of the Old Testament than reject it, leads you to wonder, is he saying then that before his time there were more who rejected it? So the Old Testament was an enormous embarrassment to Christians, to the early Christians. They dealt with it by either interpreting it allegorically or just relying on it for sources of prophecy. Or if a flood, Noah would stand for something. Noah stands for goodness.
So it's a metaphor.
And the flood stands for matter. And God preserved goodness in spite light of the existence of the material world. There was a quote that I read by Dostoevsky one time. He had written a short story, and some critic had interpreted it as an allegory. And Dostoevsky was irate, and he said, I can't remember exactly how he put it, but basically he was saying, if you interpret something allegorically, you can interpret it to mean anything. And that's true. Okay, there are some very important repercussions of the fate of Jewish Christianity on the development of Christian thought. The first is, the early Christian church completely lost the understanding of the Old Testament. They were embarrassed of it, and they did not even try to understand it. And had they tried to understand it, I think they probably would have had a very difficult time, because they had so rejected Judaism and the Jewish heritage. Well, on the whole, I don't think they do. It would have been fascinating to know what existed in Jerusalem at the time it was destroyed. What records, what books. There was a lot that was lost. And my guess is that a scholar of the Bible at that time could have had a field day researching things in Jerusalem about Judaism and understanding the Old Testament. But that's all lost. And there's a lot of history and background and culture that knowledge of that sort of thing is assumed by the Old Testament writers. And without that knowledge, it's hard to understand a lot of the Old Testament.
Jews at that time have preserved their own
Jewish I'm assuming order. They would have, yes. So I'm assuming that was there in the archives and was more accessible to people when Jerusalem was still standing. And that it existed in the memories of the Jewish Christians, I presume. But all of that was lost. And it's interesting that through archaeology, because of the climate of the area of Palestine, and the fact that they wrote on ceramic, wrote in ceramic, and that sort of thing, we are now able to learn things that have not been known, my guess is, since the time of Christ. Archaeologically, we're able to learn some things about the history and the culture of the time when the Old Testament was written that my guess is no one has known since Jerusalem was destroyed. I mean, they've lost their written sources. They were spread out and they were merged in with other cultures. And I don't know this for a fact, but my assumption is that they lost their memory of their cultural heritage. Now, I would say that my guess is that even at the time of Christ, it would probably have taken research to understand the Old Testament well. My guess is that one would have to have spent time in the libraries in Jerusalem to recover some important facts in order to understand the Old Testament well. My guess is that when Paul wrote, that his audience, his Jewish audience, at least, for the most part, did still have a reasonably good understanding. Paul obviously had an excellent understanding of the Old Testament, but he spent a lot of time devoted to it. More or less, the New Testament is what was used. Well, early on, it was the Old Testament that was used. In the very earliest times, the times of the apostles, it was the Old Testament that was used. But as we begin to get the split between Judaism and Christianity, less and less do they refer to the Old Testament, and more they refer to, I would guess, the preaching of the people that were traveling around, as well as the writings of the New Testament. And as best I understand it, the writings of the Apostolic Fathers gained in significance later on, and were apparently not all that significant in the very early church when they were written. Well, these here are not the New Testament.
I was asking that.
Why the New Testament? Well, they, as I understand it, were used.
Oh, okay.
Pelikan notes that He, quote, most of Christian doctrine developed in a church uninformed by any knowledge of the original text of the Hebrew Bible. It is interesting to note that none of the early church fathers, Gentile church fathers, learned Hebrew. The Old Testament was not that interesting to the early church fathers. No, the church fathers are just all the major spokesmen for the church. That's a general term. Well, they would be church fathers.
Among others.
Yes, among many, many others. None of them, except for Origen and Jerome and Justin Martyr, I don't know of any of them that knew Hebrew until the Reformation. And when you get after Tertullian in the 3rd century, none of them read either. They just did not see any need to refer to the Greek original language. Jerome's Latin translations. Jerome? Well, Jerome's translation was in the 300s. I think late 300s.
And he knew Greek.
He knew Greek. He also learned much Hebrew. But he knew Hebrew. He learned Hebrew. He didn't do the Septuagint. The Septuagint's in Greek. The Septuagint is the Old Testament translated into Greek. He learned Hebrew and he translated the Hebrew text into Latin. Jerome did. And the Greek New Testament into Latin. No, the Septuagint is the Old Testament translated into Greek. And that happened about 300 BC. Okay, the loss of the understanding of the Old Testament was one of the major repercussions. The Old Testament does not figure in to the theological discussions that the church enters into whatsoever. I would argue that we have not yet recovered the Old Testament. I think we still suffer from that, from the break that Christianity made with its Jewish heritage. And I think part of it is ignorance more than anything else. People don't know what to do with the Old Testament. It's still embarrassing to Christians. So if you count the number of times that the Old Testament is taught from in church, with the exception of myself, in church, my guess is it wouldn't be more than 10%. And then it would usually be the Psalms.
And then sing it
again. And then say it, that's right. So I think that for Christianity to be genuinely revitalized, I think we need to rediscover the Old Testament and understand it well. Here's my next point, and I'll come back to yours. The doctrine that comes out of the early Christian church was more influenced by Greek presuppositions than by Old Testament concepts. Here's a quote from Pellican. He says, hence, the de-Judaization of Christian thought contributed, for example, to the form taken by the Christological controversy, in which both sides defined the absoluteness of God in accordance with the principle of immutability, even though they drew opposite Christological conclusions from it. Here's what he's saying. In the Christological controversy, that is, the controversy over the nature of Christ, what was the nature of Christ? Both sides said it was just commonly understood that God is immutable. God cannot change. And part of that is God cannot have passions. All of that comes from Greek philosophy. That is not an Old Testament concept. That God is immutable and that God does not have passions. He cannot change. See, in the Christological controversy, they were saying God can't change. Therefore, Jesus cannot be God because Jesus is God made man. We have to work with this somehow because it's an impossibility. You can't have God become something because God is immutable. God cannot change. Well, that's from Greek philosophy. That's not the Old Testament. A lot of the controversies that arose in the early Christian church were problems that they had of combining Christianity with Greek philosophy, not in sorting out the biblical record and coming to an understanding of Christianity from the Bible. And It seems clear to me that a big reason for that, a major contribution to that problem, was they eliminated the Old Testament from their data. The Old Testament was not referred to. I think that the Reformers did an admirable job of genuinely reforming Christianity, but even they were significantly influenced by their past, I think. And the third repercussion, and last, is, and Pelikan points this out, and it's kind of, it seems kind of humorous to me, that in the church's feeble attempt to try to draw upon the Old Testament, they gave lip service to the fact that it's the Word of God. They felt obligated to pay attention to it to one degree or another. They appropriated some of the Old Testament religion in completely different forms. And Pelikan points out the priesthood as being an example. There was no attempt to understand how the priesthood